Hi, I'm Greg Kokel with Stand to Reason, and I have a confession to make. To be perfectly candid, evangelism is hard for me. Now, that probably surprises you, given my background. I've spent nearly half a century defending Christianity, frequently one-on-one, many times before university audiences, sometimes on television and radio, and often opposed by hostile witnesses. Even so, there it is. Evangelism is a challenge. You know, I have friends who love sharing the gospel, and I'm glad for them, but that's not me. I share my faith, of course, but it's still a challenge, and I bet I'm not alone. Maybe you're like me. Few things cause more guilt for believers than sharing their faith. They feel guilty because they don't do it enough, and they don't do it enough because they're scared. And they're scared for good reason. Sharing the gospel and defending the gospel, apologetics, often feels like navigating a minefield these days. And for most of us, talking with others about spiritual things doesn't come easy, especially when people are hostile. And that discomfort is one of the reasons that we often stay off the street, so to speak, when it comes to spiritual issues. We stay away from those environments where we don't feel safe. Most of us wouldn't wander into a local atheist club or mingle with the marchers in a gay pride parade. It's too scary. We don't know how to handle ourselves. Well, guess what? The Apostle Paul felt just the same. Listen to this, Acts 18, verse 9. The Lord said to Paul in a night vision, "Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking, do not be silent, for I am with you." Wow, Paul was afraid? Yeah. And not only that, when Jesus sent his disciples out on their first short-term mission, you find that in Matthew 10, he told them, "Do not fear," three times in seven sentences. Why did he do that? Because he knew there were reasons to be anxious. Now, Jesus said not to worry. They had an ally they could count on. It was the Holy Spirit. That's good advice, of course, but it's often misunderstood because there's another detail a lot of people miss about the disciples' situation. Jesus didn't give this assurance at the beginning of his ministry, but right in the middle. Here's what he said at the beginning, "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men." In other words, Jesus was going to instruct them. He was going to equip them. He was going to prepare them before they hit the street. And that's the rationale behind Street Smarts. Following Jesus' example, I want to teach you how to be more effective fishers of men. I want to help equip you in a specific way to address the challenges to your Christian convictions that you're going to face. So, what do I mean by the street? Well, the street is anywhere you feel vulnerable, out of your element, exposed to danger. We keep our distance from threats that we don't think we can handle. Just like the Hebrew spies encountering giants in the promised land, we feel like grasshoppers in our own sight. The challenges seem bigger than they actually are sometimes, and we seem smaller. The giants are real, but they're not as big as you think. I want you to consider something that intimidates lots of Christians, yet actually works in favor of Christianity in a way that maybe you didn't realize. When you think about it, there are many ways to show that Christianity is false. Now, I'm sure you didn't expect me to say that, right? But it's true. Our story starts in the beginning, God. But if there's no God, then there's no story, right? End of issue. Christians are disciples of Jesus. But if Jesus never existed, then our project does get off the ground. If there's no soul that survives the death of our bodies, no one goes to heaven or hell. So what's the point of the good news? If right and wrong are just a matter of personal opinion, moral relativism, there's no real sin. So judgment in a place like hell makes no sense anyway. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, Paul himself says, we of most people should be pitied. Okay, now these are all challenges that represent what might be called the soft underbelly of Christianity. It's where we're vulnerable, right? There are beliefs we hold that make us vulnerable because, at least in principle, we could be mistaken. Now, another way of saying this is that Christianity is falsifiable. It can be shown to be false. It can be disproved. But if it can be disproved, that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. If a view is falsifiable, then it's also verifiable, able to be shown to be true. And that's exactly what Christians can do. Those challenges don't destroy Christianity because they don't succeed. We have the evidence, and we have the answers. And I'll give those answers to you in this course. Here in Street Smarts, I'll give you the tools that you need to face and tear down the strongholds raised up against the knowledge of God. That's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10. So I've started this series in an odd way, admitting at the outset that the task we face can be daunting, because I don't want you to be overwhelmed by the thought of the challenge. There's a better way. Get Street Smart. That's what I'll help you do in this course. It's natural for us to feel vulnerable when we are vulnerable. Jesus anticipated it. He warned us in advance. Paul experienced it, just like you and I do, and he overcame it. And you can overcome it too, with a helping hand. So let me ask you a question. Do you like taking tests? Probably not. Most people don't. Let me ask you another question. Do you mind taking tests when you know the answers? Oh, that's different, isn't it? So here's the simple truth. The giants shrink when you learn how to deal with them. Well, that takes information. It's part of the training Jesus gave his own team, and it's the kind of training I'll give you here. The training, then, actually consists of two different parts. First, the content. In order to use questions to answer challenges, you have to know the answers to the challenges. You have to see where the weaknesses are. But when you begin to see the flaws in some of the toughest opposition you'll face as a Christian, those giants are going to shrink. And this brings us to the second point. There's more to making your case, obviously, than seeing the flaws. You also need to know how to tactfully expose the weaknesses you've discovered. And you'll do that by using specific questions in a precise and particular manner. Jesus said to be shrewd, but gentle. That's exactly what's needed on the street. So, for each particular challenge, I'll supply the questions to help you smoothly enter into that conversation. I'll then expand on those initial questions into sample dialogues that will guide you forward according to the game plan. And that's how you'll bring the weaknesses to light in a gracious and disarming way. Now, these mini dialogues won't be complete, of course. They're just helping get you going. It's hard to know how any conversation will play out in the long run, but they will be enough to get you moving ahead in a good direction. And once you're in the driver's seat of the conversation, and that's the key advantage to the game plan, you'll gain momentum, making the rest of the dialogue a whole lot easier. Now remember, these sample conversations are model exchanges. They're not precise scripts that you need to memorize. Instead, what I want you to do is to try to internalize the key questions that give you a clear grasp of the basic direction you want to go. The core ideas I offer, and you can weave those into your conversations in a friendly way that fits your own personality. Make it your own. But let me give you an encouragement. The Street Smarts approach has proven itself over decades that I've been using it myself in a host of hostile encounters, and it's also been true for thousands of other people that I've taught this approach over the years. It's allowed them to maneuver almost effortlessly and with complete safety when talking with others, even in the most challenging conversations. So, simply put, I want to make a hard job easier for you, much easier. I'm going to show you how to maneuver effectively and comfortably in conversations using questions, that's a key, to answer the challenges you face as a Christian. And by confronting the giants one by one, I'll shrink them down to size for you. Quick warning. The answers I'm going to give you to the objections you'll face on the street are good ones. They're gleaned from years of sitting at the feet of others a lot smarter, more experienced than me. Plus, the tactical game plan is really solid. I have honed it over thousands of hours of conversation with challengers and critics. Even so, there's no silver bullets, no guarantees. Here's why. On their own, no accurate information, no clever technique is going to ensure anyone is convinced and turned to Christ. A bunch of factors shape people's beliefs, and many have nothing to do with sound thinking. Real conversions, as opposed to decisions, generally take honest soul searching and lots of time. Plus, the process is rarely tidy. You know this, partly because life isn't tidy, all right? no matter, even if your conversations do not initially appear to bear fruit, even if your conversations are messy and herky-jerky. I've had a lot of those. Don't despair, because the long-term impact of your faithfulness and your witness can really be profound. Trust me on this. I've seen it happen, and it's happened time after time in my own life. So here's my advice. Your task is to present the truth as clearly, as graciously, as persuasively, and as faithfully as you can. And guess what? The rest, it's up to God. 100%. You do the talking, God does the persuading. Simple. In my opinion, though, being effective on the street these days means we need to revise our thinking about witnessing and evangelism. So, and this is controversial for some people, but hear me out. Instead of pressing for a quick harvest, we need to settle for some, what I call, gardening, okay? Let me start by making an admission that might surprise you. In fact, it may even shock you. It could make your conversations easier, safer, and much more effective than you ever thought possible. So here's my confession. I haven't prayed with anyone to receive Christ in over 30 years. I've been a Christian nearly half a century. I've spoken on over 80 college and university campuses. I've publicly defended Christianity on 6 continents, but I have not led anyone to Christ in decades. I know what you're thinking. What a loser, right? But from a biblical perspective, it makes perfect sense, because I've stumbled upon something I wish I had seen years ago, since the Gospels and the book of Acts are thick with this. And as a result, I have never been more effective for the cause of Christ than I have in these last 30 years, even without logging a bunch of decisions. So let me give you the backstory here. I became a Christian back in the 70s during the Jesus movement. Back then, you just give the simple gospel, answered a few questions, invite people to receive Christ, people prayed, and they received Christ. Okay, not too tricky. Okay, times have changed, though. The gospel is not simple anymore. No, the truth is still the truth, and it always will be, but the way people hear the truth, that has changed dramatically. Why? Because the cultural conversation has changed dramatically. So our task is to make the unchanging message and its foundational ideas more intelligible to contemporary ears, okay? Now, in the 70s, Christian words and Christian doctrines made sense to people. The people were familiar with all of that. Then they became increasingly post-Christian in their views, and now they have become anti-Christian, okay? The hostility nowadays is not just against the gospel proper, that's always been a stumbling block, but against virtually every detail of the biblical view of reality, what it means to be human, what it means to be gendered, what it means to be moral, even what it means for something to be true. Now, lots of people think that the smart crowd has weighed in and found Christianity to be wanting, both rationally and morally now. So they have no reason to give our message a second thought. People don't understand our ideas, so they don't understand our message. The gospel seems obsolete, antiquated, and irrelevant to them. That confusion can be spiritually lethal, as Jesus points out. Now, in Matthew 13, Jesus gives the parable of the sower. I've read this many, many times before, and it's just recently something stood out for me that I never saw before. You remember the parable. First, the seeds are sown, and they fall beside the road, okay, and the birds swoop in, they carry them away. And, well, there's no mystery here. This is hard ground, right? Hard ground, no growth. Some people just don't listen. Not too complicated. But there's more to Jesus' point, and this is what I didn't notice in the past. When he explains to his disciples what he meant, here's what he says. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what's been sown in his heart. Now, that's the seed that's sown on the road. The seed is sown, true enough. In fact, it lands in the heart, according to Jesus. It's not just bouncing off of tough turf. Yet something critical is missing. Jesus tells us what that is. He says that the word sown in the hearer's heart is not understood. So when people are spiritually puzzled, they become easy prey. The word of life is quickly snatched away by the devil. According to Jesus, what's the difference between the first group and the last group? Between the ones who bear nothing and the ones who bear abundance? The difference is this. The second group understands the message. The first group doesn't. They become roadkill. This insight is central, I think, to something Paul says in Colossians chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. And here's what he says. First, he says, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. So he starts by saying, be smart. Good. Then he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt. Be smart. Be nice. How about that? And then he adds, so you'll know how you should respond to each person. Now, that last phrase, that's critical. People are individuals. People have their own ideas. They have their own backgrounds. They have their own experiences, okay? And if our evangelistic game plan focuses only on the end of that journey, that would be the harvest. That's the way it was in the 70s, Jesus' movement. Then we're not following Paul's directions because we're not focusing our communication uniquely on each person. So I'd like to offer an antidote based on the insight that's made all the difference for me. And the antidote is kind of an aphorism. It's a pithy statement that is profound. And this one is just very obvious, all right? But it's completely transformed how I personally do evangelism. Here it is. Before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of, let's just call it, gardening. Fruitful harvest, in other words, is always dependent on prior spade work, sowing, watering, weeding, nurturing. That was what was happening to me as a college student at UCLA in 1973. I was testing the Christian waters. I was asking questions. I was pushing back a lot, eventually listening. And then on Friday night, September 28, 1973, when the fruit was ripe, it fell into the basket. So don't miss this. When the spade work is done well, the gardening, the harvest pretty much takes care of itself. Ripe fruit is easy to harvest. And by the way, you may not have noticed this, but were there any altar calls in the Gospels or the book of Acts? None. Jesus said in John chapter 4 in the account of the woman at the well. You're familiar with this account. It's well known. A lot of sermons about it, a lot of good stuff in there. But I want to talk about something that Jesus says after that famous conversation. Okay? The disciples come up to him, and they hadn't been part of the conversation. And he says to the disciples, you say there are 4 months, and then come the harvest. I say to you, look on the fields, and they are white for harvest. Now, Jesus wasn't saying, I don't think, that every field is always ready for harvest. But Sychar was. That's where they were at. And then he says, you are about to reap where you did not sow. Okay? Now, I want you to notice something in that statement. You are about to reap where you did not sow. Okay? He was identifying one field, Sychar in that case. But there were two different seasons. There was a sowing season. There was a reaping season. There was a gardening season. There was a harvesting season. And one team, God's people, but two types of workers. Those who reap and those who sow. Those who harvest and those who garden. Now, in Sychar, it was reaping season. Someone else had done the heavy lifting. The disciples were now going to get the easy pickings. They were going to get the low-hanging fruit, right? Now, some Christians are convinced that we should try to get to the gospel in every encounter. I think there are problems with this approach, especially in the culture we're in now. And one problem is we're not listening to people long enough to learn their cultural language. And if we don't listen to understand their views, how are we going to communicate so they understand our views? If our words of truth fall on deaf ears, there's no understanding. And those precious gospel seeds get whisked away, and the devil wins. But there's a second problem. What happens to all those Christians who are not good at harvesting? They might be great gardeners, But all they have is a harvesting model of evangelism. What do? They sit on the bench. They're out of play. The idea of pressing someone for a decision, especially in today's hostile environment, that's just too scary. The fact is, most of us are not good closers, so we never get in the game. And when gardeners don't garden, the harvest suffers. Now, don't misunderstand me. Harvesting is critical. There'd be no kingdom growth without it. But without the spade work, without the plowing, without the planting, without the cultivating, gardening, there's no kingdom growth either. There is no good harvest without good gardening. Now, remember what Jesus said. One sows, then the other reaps. And that's why I don't feel compelled to kind of shoehorn the gospel into my conversations in an odd or artificial way, pushing towards the finish line if it's not natural in the circumstances. And by the way, even Jesus didn't get to the gospel in every conversation. I mean, in fact, think of his most famous discourse, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, right? It's almost all bad news, not good news. He was preparing them for the good news that he gave later. When I'm in conversation that I hope will lead to spiritual matters, I never have it as an immediate goal to lead that person to Christ. It's not on my mind. I don't try to close the deal. In fact, I don't even have it as a goal in a conversation necessarily to get to the gospel. I may end up there, but that's not what I'm looking for at the beginning. Do I want that person to come to Christ? Sure. Of course. Is the gospel necessary? Yeah. It's the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. All right. But getting to the gospel is not the issue. Let's go back to the parable of the sower for a moment. The problem is the ground the seed falls on. There's no understanding. The hard ground needs tilling first before the seed has any chance to take root. And so I have a more modest goal. And I explain this goal whenever I speak to a university audience. I always start out the same way. And here's what I tell them. I'm here tonight because my life has been deeply changed by an ancient teacher. That's Jesus of Nazareth. And then I tell them a little bit about coming to Christ back in 1973. And then I tell them, look, I'm not here to convert you tonight. All right, and it's a collective sigh of relief, right? I said, I have a more modest goal, and here it is. I tell them, I just want to put a stone in your shoe. All right? You ever have a stone in your shoe? That's kind of annoying, isn't it? It's not the end of the world, but you want to address it. Then I tell them that. I said, I want to annoy you a little bit in a good way. All right? I want to have you thinking about something I've said when you walk out of here. That's the stone in your shoe. And if I've done that, I'm a happy camper. That's what I tell them. And then I go on with my talk, whatever it happens to be. Now, you might be thinking, does this guy ever get to the gospel? Yeah, of course I do. Well, when do you get to the gospel? I said, I'll tell you what, I get to the gospel whenever I want. Now, I know that sounds a little cheeky, but the point is I'm trying to get to the gospel when it seems to be appropriate in the conversation. When I can position it in a meaningful way. When it fits the natural flow of the conversation that I'm having. And Jesus understood this. He took his time. He paced himself. He weighed his words so he could be sensitive to his own audience and to the unique circumstances they faced. In John chapter 3, he was different with Nicodemus than he was in John chapter 4 with the woman at the well. I mean, a lot of times, he only goes halfway giving the bad news. Sure, he got to the good news eventually, but first, even Jesus gardened. Now, I want to let you in on something I've noticed with audiences over the many years that I've taught this concept publicly. I can see in their eyes something slowly beginning to dawn on them. And here is what they're thinking. I can do this. I can do this. Gardening. I'm not good at harvesting, but I can do this. And they're right. They can. Because lowering the bar gets them off the bench and into the garden. And that means a bigger harvest in the long run. Which brings me back to my original confession, the one that made me sound like a pathetic Christian and haven't led anybody to Christ in the last 30 years. Years ago, I realized I was not a harvester, but a gardener. All the speaking that I do, all the radio that I do, and the public presentations I do, the books that I write, what am I doing? I'm gardening, okay? And since the hard work is in the gardening, I actually think most Christians are gardeners too. They just haven't thought of themselves that way, since the option was never really open to them. And here's something else you need to know. You might have heard of this guy named J. Warner Wallace, okay? He was the cold case detective who was able to find the bad guy after the murder had been cold for 20 or 30 years. He never lost a case that went to trial. He was a great detective. He knew how testimony worked. He knew how evidence worked, but he was an atheist, all right? And then he took his skills as a detective and applied him to the New Testament and became convinced that the resurrection happened. He became a Christian. Then he became an apologist. Then he became a best-selling Christian author. In fact, Jim Wallace is, to me, the best apologist available on the planet. He's fabulous, okay? But here's something you don't know about J. Warner Wallace and his book, Cold Case Christianity, which you might have read. What you don't know is that Jim Wallace was in my garden when he was an atheist. Now, I want to tell you what, I wasn't there to lead him to Christ. Somebody else was responsible for that, okay? You know what happened? Somebody went into my garden. They harvested my crop. Get out of my garden. Is that my attitude? No, that isn't my attitude. Remember Jesus' words, the one who reaps and the one who sows can rejoice together. We're all on the same team. One field, one team, two different seasons, two different kind of workers. In the body of Christ, different people have different gifts. When it comes to working the field, some sow and some reap. That's what Jesus taught. So, how do you know if you're a gardener or a harvester? It's real easy. I can ask you, how are you feeling right now after what I've said about these two categories? If what I've said really bugs you, if you're annoyed at me, if you're thinking you're letting people off too easily, if you think I should be pushing you harder to close the deal in spiritual conversations, well, you're probably a harvester. That's why you're bugged at me. I'm glad you are, by the way. We need you. If, on the other hand, what I've said encourages you, if you're thinking, I can do this, then you're probably a gardener. And I think that would be most Christians. And we need you, too. So, if it's beginning to dawn on you that you might be a gardener like me, then make it your modest goal in your conversations to just put a stone in someone's shoe. Focus your efforts on giving them maybe just one thing to think about. That's plenty good for starters. Don't worry about the end game. Don't worry about leading them to Christ. Just get busy doing some spade work. Remember, you don't have to swing for the fences. You don't even have to get on base, as far as I'm concerned. You just need to get in the batter's box. And that's what Street Smarts will help you to do. And then you can let the Lord take things from there. That's the secret and the beauty of gardening. And if you do that, if you get off the bench and get into play in simple ways that are friendly yet moderately challenging, you're going to see a dramatic difference in your impact for the kingdom. Don't forget, the more gardeners we have, the bigger harvest we'll have. Then, he who sows and he who reaps can rejoice together. And once you're off the bench, you're off the sidelines, you're out on the street, it really helps if you have a game plan. And that's what I'll give you in our next session of Street Smarts. I'm Greg Hochul for Stand to Reason. I'll see you next time.